The topic of the retreat is concentration. And so the title of this talk on the first night of our retreat together is concentration. The term in Pali that's usually translated as concentration is samadhi. And samadhi describes a calmness and a unification of mind that occurs when the mind is concentrated. The Visuddhimagga says that samadhi is recognized to be too varied to neatly define. There's too many diverse aspects of it to reduce samadhi to a very simple definition. And yet it can be described as, quote, a profitable unification of mind. So samadhi doesn't just mean a single-pointed attention, nor does it mean focusing on a particular object, but it describes this profitable unification of mind. There's tremendous value in concentration. It takes concentration to let the attention rest very deeply and simply on the breathing. It takes concentration to let go of the tendency to dwell on thoughts of the past or plans for the future, to let go of fears, frustrations, worries, all those obsessions and preoccupations of mind. This calmness that's a part of the unified mind arises at moments when we are not craving for the pleasant nor pushing away the unpleasant. The mind is steady. We're not grasping, nor are we averse. We're not resisting our experience, and we're not trying to fix it. But the body and mind can open to experience a non-distracted, non-discursive, well-settled, non-conceptual experience of the moment, that deep, calm abiding. There's tremendous tranquility in samadhi. We experience this tranquility when we recognize that our minds simply are not caught in the complexities of discursive thinking all the time. So we find that concentration practice has the effect of uprooting the stickiness of the mind, of getting caught again and again in the same patterns, caught in dwelling and thinking about this and that. All those familiar patterns of mind can radically change when we do samadhi practice. Sometimes what shifts isn't so much the relationship to thought, well, that does shift, but we might also notice that our relationship to feeling changes. And there can be a habitual reaction to feelings. Certain feelings might trigger certain reactions that are very quick, very strong in the mind. It could be pleasant experiences trigger craving, and unpleasant experiences trigger anger or irritation, judgment, criticism. And deep experiences of samadhi tend to disentangle consciousness from these habitual reactions. So the mind, without these disturbing patterns, without these habitual reactions, can rest. We can feel deeply rejuvenated, restored, energized. Samadhi practice is deeply healing. It's said that there are three kinds of concentration, three kinds of samadhi. The first is called kanika samadhi in Pali, and in English it's translated as momentary concentration. This is the kind of concentration, the kind of samadhi that we develop in Vipassana practice. The second kind in Pali is called upachara samadhi, and it's translated as neighborhood concentration or access to jhana. The third kind is apana samadhi, which describes a state of concentration sufficient for absorption. The level of concentration is determined by the refinement of consciousness from moment to moment as we train the mind to maintain its awareness and its attention to the meditation object. But each level, every level of samadhi, anything that could be called samadhi, describes a mind that is deeply calm, unified, and tranquil. Though the depth of the samadhi varies and the quality changes, the nature of the state of samadhi is deeply peaceful and still. So I want to look at these three kinds of samadhi in more detail. The first, kanaka samadhi, momentary concentration. I think most of you are probably familiar with this kind of concentration, and it may be that having experienced this kind of concentration is what has heightened your interest in exploring a retreat based on concentration. The mind can get deeply concentrated doing vipassana practice. Vipassana doesn't exclude samadhi from developing. It just develops concentration along with the mindfulness in a kind of a tandem or dual or twin fashion, so that the depth of the concentration never gets out of balance with the depth of, with the strength of the mindfulness, and they continue to support each other. Which in jhana practice too, we develop mindfulness along with with concentration, but we balance them a little bit differently so that the concentration becomes a little bit stronger. But we're always developing mindfulness in this practice. Just as any practice of mindfulness will always have a component as well that is of concentration. But in a vipassana practice, when we're developing kanaka samadhi, the mind is unified. There's still this unification of consciousness, but it's only unified moment by moment by moment by moment, because the sensations that we are observing continue to change. So there's a unification, say, on a quality of tingling, but then it changes to a quality of pressure. And as the sensations change, the mind is steady, but it's not steady on a fixed object. It's steady with changing sensations, a changing object. So it's as though the mind momentarily collects and then disperses, then collects and disperses with the flow of changing perceptions. The mind is said to still wander, but it only wanders around and within the concentrated state. We're not wandering off to thoughts about the past and thoughts about the future, all of those sort of distracted things that occur before samadhi. So our thoughts are not creating agitation. The content of the thought is entirely wholesome and usually just has to do with different aspects of the meditation object or what's happening in the present moment, or a shift to sound, or, oh, there's a thought, and there's a tingle, and there's a feeling of unpleasantness, and there's an understanding of perception. So it's all very present moment, which is why the mind is collected and unified, because it's unified in momentary concentration. But each of the objects are different and varied. Ajahn Chah compares kanaka samadhi to taking a walk, resting, walking, resting, walking, resting. It's a lovely way to take a stroll, to walk, to stand, to look at a flower, to walk, to rest, to look at to listen to a frog, to walk, to rest, to walk, to rest. Each time we rest, it's as though the journey is momentarily interrupted. But basically, the journey is not disturbed, because in a short time, we continue again, and then continue again, and then continue again. So this process of developing concentration moment by moment by moment is something that I think we're all experienced with, and will have experienced these states of very calm unification, clarity, calmness, tranquility within the Vipassana practice that includes changing objects. But in this practice that I'll be teaching you this week, and for the attainment of jhana, absorption states, we use a fixed object for concentration. And this fixed object is the characteristics of the next two kinds of samadhi. Upachara samadhi, translated as neighborhood concentration, or I've been using the phrase access to jhana, entails firm samadhi on a fixed or singular object, and this fixed quality calms the mind. There can still be some movement of mind right around the meditation object to really know it, to sense our effort, to sense how are we connecting with that focus. But it's as though what Ajahn Chah says, this is like, whereas he said, he compared compared Kanaka Samadhi to taking a walk, resting and walking. He compares Upachara Samadhi to wandering about inside your own home. You know, you just go from the living room to the hallway, to the bathroom, to the kitchen. You're really not moving off your object. You're just moving around it and experiencing different facets of it. So thinking might still arise in this very simple exploration of the meditation object. But we won't be thinking about anything else. And it's as though we're just circling around this experience of breath. There's calm tranquility, and whenever samadhi arises, you'll find, I think, that calmness, that composure, that steadiness will permeate the rest of the day. There'll be a stillness that will be very dramatic in the sittings, but the effect of the samadhi will spill over as you get up and move to your shoes and as you go to the dining hall. You'll sense that composure remains. And so we do a lot in this practice to protect the mind, to maintain the concentration, even as we move between buildings, between our shoes and the dining room, in our yogi job, our work in meditation. So right from the beginning of this retreat, now that we've entered into the silence, even as you're settling into your room, begin to bring attention to every aspect of your experience. Not the kind of attention where we note every movement or experience vividly all of the changes, but bring a quality of composure, of ease, of inner centeredness, inner quietude as you go about your activities, so that there's a real simplicity of being. And you might find that it's easy as you step out to be pulled out into exploring, into hearing, into interacting, into wondering who's coming, into wanting to look here or there, and just drop again and again into not a dullness, but a clear inner composure. That as you're walking, experiences the temperature, experiences your body moving, but from that place of stillness, so that you sense how the tranquility, how the calmness pervades not just the stillness, but also the movement. In the middle-length discourses, the Buddha said, if I think and ponder upon thoughts of letting go. Even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when my body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed, and it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind and concentrated it so that it would not be disturbed. I like this verse because there are many things that we find our minds go out after. And in daily life, they might go out after all sorts of activities and accomplishments and things that have to do with our egos and our families and our life and our stories. But in retreat, sometimes our minds go out after subtle sensory experiences, or they go out after subtle emotional experiences or subtle mental experiences, so that we can catch it and then let it go, catch it and then let it go, and kind of do a lot of work in the meditation. That can tire our minds. And the Buddha speaks very, very simply about concentrating the mind, steadying the mind, simplifying our experience so that we collect that energy so that it will not be disturbed. We protect our mind. The third kind of samadhi is apana samadhi, which is the quality of samadhi that can lead to absorption or jhana. This is when the mind is utterly still, completely still and one-pointed on its object. Even if there are sounds or sensations, the mind remains completely undisturbed, completely calm. There's even quite a bit of discussion among jhana teachers as to whether or not it is possible to experience sound or sensation and still call it jhana or absorption. Because the state of absorption or jhana is so deep, and the sense of absorption, the definition of absorption, describes a repeated connection with the single object again and again and again, such that the mind absorbs in it. So if we go out to hear sounds or move to pain in the body, for that moment, we have a different mind object, a different mental object rather than our meditation object. And so that's considered by many to be a breach of jhana. But the sense at first is at least the mind is undisturbed by it and perhaps doesn't even recognize those other sounds. Certainly, there is no sensory contact that could disturb a mind that has the depth of tranquility of jhana. It's almost like the ear isn't stuffed with cotton. There's nothing blocking the ear. But it's as though we just don't really hear it, hear the sounds, even if there are birds out and people moving about and some machine. And yet we're not spacing out. We're not dull. We're utterly clear. But the attention is not moving to the sense doors because it's so focused on its object, which for us will be the breath. Teachers who teach a lighter stage of jhana say that the awareness of the contact, say of senses or of hearing, can still occur in some of the lower absorption states, perhaps the first jhana, perhaps the second. But the mind lets go so automatically that there is no residue to that sensory contact. It's as though it's just the touch of a breeze, even though it was a stabbing sensation to the leg. It's just like, oh, huh. And we're still centered. We're completely undisturbed. There's no reaction whatsoever to the contact. I found this to be very true because, as you know, I have a back injury that increases with sitting. And when you do the jhana practice, before you enter into the jhana, you're supposed to make a determination of the length of time you will remain absorbed. And what's amazing is that the mind comes out more or less exactly when you choose. But when I was first learning the system, like I said, I was, you know, finding my way and didn't have complete instructions. And there were times when I would enter into the concentration and oversit the duration that my injury permitted. And I would have no painful sensations at all during the experience of the sitting. And then I would come out, and then it would be clear as day. And it wasn't that the pain brought me out. There would be another reason why I would come out, like the lunch bell rang or something like that. but it was still a sense that the body becomes quite remote in this particular form of samadhi called apanasamadhi, which is not the case with kanaka samadhi. With some kanaka samadhi, with changing objects, we are vividly aware and can even attain deep experiences of kanaka samadhi by focusing on pain. Oh, you know, really focus in on that knee pain or that back pain and feel the twinges and the increase and the decrease and how it goes to icy. That's a very different quality of concentration than what I'm going to be teaching you this week. Apanasamadhi, because it's so still and so removed from the agitation of the senses, can be sustained for very long periods of time. You'll find it easier and easier to sit longer and longer as the retreat goes on. The mind, once it attains samadhi, is very peaceful. So there's very little that will disturb it. But then when the meditation session ends and we get up, or when we decide to emerge from the absorption state and then continue to sit, then we re-enter the world of the senses, the world of the mind. And so images might arise, perceptions of the body might arise. This is the pivotal moment for insight practice. Traditionally, one would enter jhana, stay absorbed for a certain period of time of our choosing to sharpen and strengthen the mind, and then emerge from the jhana, the absorption, but continue the sitting so that we could apply that samadhi to changing sensory experience and experience clear seeing, vipassana. So this is a process of insight that can occur when that concentrated mind encounters sensory experience. Many people sense the body in a new way and might really get a different insight into dukkha, into the unsatisfactoriness of conditioned things. It's not uncommon to have a experience of emptiness or a clarity of seeing the lack of self-existence to things, or to have a deep understanding of impermanence upon emerging from jhana. The images, insights, and understandings have a deep impact on the mind because of the strength of the concentration. They penetrate consciousness at a deep and profound level, deeper than any analytical or discursive understanding could bring. It's not enough to read a book about jhana. It's not enough to understand the system or to debate the differences of various techniques of jhana. Which one is deeper? Which one is better? Which one is right? Which one is practical? Which one makes sense for a Western mind? Which ones make sense for a lay person? All those understandings are of little importance unless we can sit down and quiet our minds. When we're calm and clear, profound insight gives rise to the experience that is called dispassion, a dispassion towards body, towards material attachments, towards all conditioned things. It ends the passion for, the desire for, more of this and more of that for myself. The effect of insight, of dispassion, of the disentanglement of the mind from attachments is very transformative when the mind is concentrated. So insight arising from the stillness of concentration sees deeply insight into anicca, dukkha, and anatta, the insight into impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness of conditioned things, and the not-self aspect of conditioned things. It can put an end to clinging. Such penetrating insight has the potential to liberate the mind from all forms of grasping and lead to an understanding that is firm and unshakable. We can see mind and matter for what they are without identification, without attachment. Even illnesses, even fevers, even threats to our lives are said not to be able to shake the understanding that arises from a concentrated mind. But as strong as concentration is, and as potent as the insight that arises from concentration, the development of concentration is kind of fragile. We need protected conditions to develop concentration. We need to really nurture it. It's like a delicate plant that we have to water and grow. And some of the conditions that are required for concentration to develop include, first of all, being able to set aside our entanglements in the world for sustained periods of time. It's not enough just to sit for 1 hour a day to do these kinds of practices. It takes time. So the first external support that you're giving yourself is you've come on this retreat. The second support is an internal one, which is to establish an attitude of inner solitude and attention, so that we're focusing on silence and a quietness of mind. Because we could leave home, but, you know, come here and chit-chat and socialize and check everybody out and do this and that, and maybe have all kinds of other projects. And then though we had left our home life, we might not have established the inner conditions. So if we do both, we establish external conditions and internal conditions. And this helps to support the next condition, which is a gladness of mind. It's said that a glad mind is easily concentrated. So even though this practice can be very strict and very precise, it's not at all grim. It gives rise to a quality of joy and delight and rapture and gladness. But we capture that gladness internally and circulate it within so that it continues to support the concentration, rather than express it outwardly. There are many techniques that we can use to develop stronger concentration. In this retreat, we'll be using various techniques, such as counting breaths and focusing on the breath in different ways, and I'll introduce some of the instructions from the suttas on mindfulness with breathing and the various practices that are given. You can also develop concentration in other ways that we won't be doing on this retreat, but they still develop concentration, focusing on an image, a visualization, a mantra such as Buddha, repeating phrases like the metta phrases. Any time we really commit to coming back to our chosen object, we are developing concentration. But for this retreat, we'll be doing Anapanasati Samadhi, concentration due to mindfulness with breathing. Anapanasati Samadhi. The Visuddhimagga lists 10 factors that support the development of concentration. And I'd like to review those tonight so that hopefully they will help establish you in this practice. The first is cleanliness. Cleanliness. I always loved this one coming first. Cleanliness. So, you know, it's very simply that if we leave our socks here and our shirt there and our toothbrush over there and our toothpaste over there, it's very easy to become distracted. Things are out of place, they're disorganized, we can't find them easily, we're driving our roommate crazy, and our roommate's in silence, so they're just grunting because they can't say anything. Oh, by the way, silence includes not leaving notes for your roommates or each other. That's part of the silence, is really not communicating with each other. So hopefully by now you've arranged whatever you needed to arrange about windows or whatever you need to arrange with your roommate. So keeping our areas clean or organized. I mean, it doesn't mean that you have to go around scrubbing everything, but a general sense of organization supports concentration, whereas disarray can lead to distraction in the mind. But this also includes personal hygiene. You know, if you ever not taken a bath for a week, maybe been trekking or something, and then you sit down and you meditate, and most of your meditation is on your own smell. Maybe you haven't had that glorious experience, or maybe all of you are travelers and have had that glorious experience. But personal hygiene also supports concentration. It is very helpful on a retreat to not use scented products, because if you get really into sprucing up your hair with some goo, then the person next to you might be meditating on the smell of it and can't find their breath. So also, you know, the sense that we're talking about cleanliness, not a lot of sprucing. There's also the aspect of hygiene that just supports health. And we recommend always in retreats in the States, and I was just to cough into the arm, or if you're wearing a t-shirt or something, into the shirt, so that you don't, like if you have to cough or sneeze, cough into the hand, because you just imagine coughing into the hand, you think you're covering it up, and then you open the door and you touch something and then the next person comes through. And I was taking a class this past semester in the training for emergency response for like ambulance work. I'm not going to go into ambulance work. It's just, you know, you never know when somebody's going to, when you're going to need it. So I was taking this course, and we had a whole unit on hygiene, and they said, cough like this, you know, and wash your hands. And I thought, oh, I only heard that on retreats. But there's a whole training in personal hygiene, and that reduces illness, and then that also helps maintain concentration because it helps maintain health. So this was the very first one listed in the traditional texts of cleanliness and hygiene. I love that these are so practical. Sometimes we think, oh, Visuddhimagga, it's got to be so spiritual, but it's very practical. Step two is to continuously balance our practice, to balance the mind, faith and wisdom, energy and concentration. We need a certain amount of faith, but if it's out of balance with wisdom, then it'll be blind faith. But if we're only just discerning, but don't have enough faith to try something, then this will be an academic pursuit, because there won't be enough faith to sit down and actually apply it to see where it goes. If there's too much energy, we'll get restless. But if there's too much of just the calm aspect, then we might dull out and we won't have the vibrancy that develops samadhi. So we continuously balance what are called the spiritual faculties or the controlling faculties, primarily energy and concentration, faith and wisdom. The third recommendation is to have a clear object for meditation. Now, that should be very clear because we're going to focus on the breath, just at this nostrils. But you'll notice that it'll be confusing if you're used to focusing on the abdomen and the rising and falling, and you find your attention goes there. Or you've been doing many, many different techniques, and you think, oh, I think a little metta would soften the mood right now. And you do like 15 minutes of metta. And then you think, oh, well, maybe I'll do a body sweep or two to get a little grounded. And then you do a body sweep or two. And then you think, you know, this is getting kind of boring. I should probably do this technique that I learned in this monastery, wherever, and you do that for a while. And then you think, oh, you know, I'm in this jhana retreat. I better have something to say during my next interview, so I'll focus on the breath for 2.5 minutes, and then you come back to the breath. And then you think, well, you know, maybe just some spacious awareness would put me in a good framework. Now, I do not say that there is an only way, and I love to have a big tool chest of meditation techniques and to play with different ones and to employ them. That said, as a general spirit of meditation, honestly, the easiest and the most effective way to develop concentration is to do only one thing and to only do that thing. Focus on the breath. That's the primary instruction, and all these other things may affect our mood, they may change this, they may tweak this, and it isn't that they're bad to do. It's just that, and if you were all tense and you thought 10 minutes of metta was going to be a great thing, okay, you know, there really are worse things you can do in this world. You know, it's not an evil thing, so fine, it's go ahead and do it. Don't feel like you're doing a great sin or that, you know, it's a criminal act. But just know that as simple as you can be will help the practice develop. As simple as you can be. Now, all of you have a background in other meditation techniques. And so at different times, it will be natural for you to, okay, let the attention rest in spacious awareness, or to just start the sitting with 10 minutes of metta. I don't mind. I really don't. But the instruction is have a clear object of meditation, which basically means don't switch around. So if you do want to insert any other practice, do so in a way that your mind doesn't flit around, so that you know, okay, I'm just going to do this for 10 minutes, and this will be fine. It's my break. Mm-hmm. That's okay. I used to, when I would do long retreats, I permitted certain breaks, and I would have certain things that I allowed myself to do. Because sometimes it's just like the mind just like, I got to have a break. You know, we get a little restless or rebellious when at certain points, and so we permit a break. And the kind of breaks that I permitted was a body scan. That was a break. And it was a radical break, actually, too. And I permitted a few minutes of metta. That was also a break. And I permitted flossing my teeth. So you can have a sense of finding when your mind is getting really, it's got to do something else. You can do that. Just know that it's a break. You know, it's a break, and you're choosing a skillful one. You know, if the alternative is to have a sexual fantasy or something, you know, choose a body scan or metta or floss your teeth. But sometimes you can sense that your mind is not going to cooperate anymore until it has a little difference, and then you adjust. I think we know our minds fairly well, and what we need to know is how to work skillfully with them to bring them in and to rein them in as much as we can. So the clear object for meditation is important. If you were to switch around between multiple objects in the meditation, it really wouldn't work. If you do a 10-minute break here or there, it's not going to be a problem. But if you try starting here and then you go to the abdomen and do rising and falling and then you do this and then you come back and then you... it's just not going to be repeated enough to develop. The fourth one is lovely. It says, to know how to uplift a discouraged mind. It's important. Sometimes we get discouraged in practice. And how can we lift our minds up? How do we inspire ourselves? Maybe that's coming into the hall. Maybe it's just receiving the support of the community. Maybe it's opening the senses a little bit to experience a flower for a moment. Maybe it's to contemplate death and to realize the preciousness of the opportunity we have here and how we cherish it. How many opportunities do we have to do a 10-day concentration retreat? Sometimes it's just a little tiny pep talk. Sometimes it's just pulling the mind up a little bit and energizing ourselves. Sometimes it's just a half smile. Sometimes it's a thought of our virtue or a thought of our generosity. But we do have to uplift our own minds when we sense that we're starting to get discouraged, so that we don't wait until we've fallen into the pit of despair and then we have to drag ourselves out with a lot of help. We just sense the mind starting to get discouraged and we boost it up and we find ways of doing that. The balance to that is to calm an over-enthusiastic mind. This is also important because in any practice, as you start to get deeper and deeper, you'll enter into states that are not familiar to you and perhaps very exciting. And in jhana practice, they're terribly pleasant. And so it's very easy to get all excited as soon as rapture starts to arise and want to run out and tell me about it and want to burst a little bit with it and calm that mind. Learn to calm that mind, not to diminish that power of the joy, but to calm the over-enthusiastic mind so we bring ourselves back into balance. The next one is also related to these balancing processes, is to cheer the mind that is withered by pain. Sometimes we hurt, and when we have to face pain hour after hour, moment after moment, it can be exhausting and the mind gets withered and shrivels from it. And so we learn to cheer ourselves a little bit, to encourage ourselves, so that that pain, again, doesn't take us down, but we have a very balanced and happy mind in relationship to the pain. The seventh is to maintain a continuous balanced awareness from the beginning to the end of each moment, each practice. The eighth and the ninth is to seek the company of focused friends and to avoid distracted friends. And I think we've accomplished that by coming here. The next is, the tenth is to reflect on the peace of absorption, to actually contemplate for a moment the possibility of experiencing such a profound peace that the mind is totally centered and unified, coherent, collected, and deeply happy. And the last one, the 11th, is to consciously incline the mind to develop concentration, because it doesn't develop by accident. Can we incline the mind, lean the mind, direct the mind, intend to develop concentration? But just as there are conditions that are required for concentration to develop. Concentration states are also impermanent, and at the end of the retreat, whatever the deepest state you've experienced, it's going to pass. It's going to change. The concentration will dissipate after the retreat. And yet whatever insight occurred, whatever understanding occurred, will affect our moment to and moment, our daily and momentary experience beyond this retreat. When the retreat comes to an end, many people have lots of questions about how they're going to take this home, how they're going to integrate it into their lives. And even very simple questions like, how am I going to drive? How am I going to go back to work tomorrow? What's the transition going to be like? And I just want to let you know that we will speak about it at the end of the retreat. And most of you have already been through quite a few retreats, so you know that there's something of a process that one goes through when we leave the protected container of silence and enter into the busyness of life. There can be a kind of disorientation in that process, and that's a very normal part of the readjustment, and it's also a very rich arena for insight. You might even feel those shifts within the retreat. If you have a busy work meditation and then you come into the hall, or you have a very deep sitting in the hall and then you go to a work meditation, you might even feel those subtle shifts within the context of the retreat that then parallel and reflect a process that will happen as you go home. The development of concentration is something that we can all do. It's not beyond your reach if we give it the time and the effort and have the intention to develop it. However, the specific attainments of genuine absorption into jhana practice doesn't occur for everyone. Sorry, there's no guarantee. Even if you do everything right, sometimes the mind just doesn't cohere. Who knows what all of the causes and conditions are required to attain these rather profound states? And I don't think anybody has a full explanation as to why some people can attain jhana and other people seem to do everything right. Their practice is really diligent. They follow the instructions entirely. They're very, very good yogis. And yet they just don't experience these particular states. So I encourage you to make a complete and full commitment to the development of concentration and simultaneously have no expectation. Don't try to compare your experience with somebody else's. And don't have any sense that there's a failure in this practice. It is not a sign of success or failure to attain jhana or not to attain jhana. Because even if jhana doesn't arise for you, you will still learn a lot and experience a deeper experience of concentration than perhaps you've ever known before. Who knows? I'd like to read a poem from one of the early nuns at the time of the Buddha, Dantika. And this was her enlightenment poem. She said, "As I left my daytime resting place on Vulture Peak, I saw an elephant come up on the riverbank after its bath. A man took a hook and said to the elephant, 'Give me your foot.' The elephant stretched out its foot and the man mounted. Seeing what was wild before gone tame under human hands, I went to the forest and concentrated my mind." We've all heard about concentration before. We've all desired deep calm, radiant peace, inner peace, inner stillness. But this is a specific training, and that's why we've come to this retreat. We've come to this retreat not to just learn about concentration and not just to participate in the retreat, but we've come to train our minds, to tame our minds. And this training can have miraculously beautiful results. There's a wonderful book that Amy Schmidt edited, and it's titled Deepama. The first edition was called Knee Deep, Deep in Grace, and the later edition is called, I think, Deepama, The Life and Legacy of a Buddhist Master. But it's a very much about the life of a great teacher named Deepama. And Deepama said, she lived in Calcutta, and she only died about maybe 18 years ago now. Wow, time flies. 18 years ago. Deepama was a very extraordinary meditator. She practiced in Burma and was just an amazing person. And she said, Amy is writing this about Deepama to start with. Deepama did not say that the mind is mostly stories. She said that there is nothing in the mind but stories. These are the personal dramas that create and maintain the sense of individual identity, who we are, what we do, what we are and are not capable of. Without our being aware of it, the endless series of such thoughts drives and limits our lives. And yet those stories are without substance. Deepama challenged students to observe the stories, to see their emptiness, and to go beyond the limitations that they impose. Let go of thinking, she urged. Meditation is not about thinking, she taught. At the same time, Deepama taught that the mind is not an enemy to be gotten rid of. Rather, in the process of befriending the mind, in getting to know it and accept it, it ceases to be a problem. Deepama knew that the freedom that follows that process, she lived in a state of thought-free awareness. Then she goes on to speak about a group interview that occurred one time when Deepama was teaching in the United States at the Insight Meditation Society, where one student asked her, rather innocently, "What is it like in your mind?" And she smiled, closed her eyes, and quietly answered, "In my mind, there are three things. Concentration, loving kindness, and peace." The student, not sure if he had actually heard her correctly, asked, "Is that all?" And Deepama replied, "Yes, that is all. Concentration, loving kindness, and peace." Let the possibility of a mind that has been trained and tamed and clarified through meditation inspire you that there's the possibility of experiencing a mind in a life. She was a layperson who had a daughter who lived in Calcutta, in very ordinary Calcutta situations, which is not very pleasant by my standards, but in a little apartment in a rather run-down neighborhood in Calcutta. But in her mind, there was concentration, loving kindness, and peace. Imagine or sense what the quality of that mind is like. Let's sit for a few minutes. May the retreat that we're undertaking together and the practice that we're doing be of benefit to all beings, to bring joy and insight, strength of heart, and calmness to all. May there be peace. We won't have an organized sitting tonight. I trust that you can practice to whatever extent you wish tonight, but for many of you coming from a busy work life, it may well be the very best thing you can do is to get a good night's sleep and to wake up here. We'll end the organized evening tonight. But first I want to just check with Nurit and see if there's any more announcements that needed to be made, if there were any jobs or anything that hadn't been filled before we go to bed. Anything that needs to be said? We're good? Okay.